Okay, good morning. Welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 200. Thank God for that, of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'm actually not going to be teaching anything, but I'm going to be going over a question that I've gotten from many med students. So this should be a relatively short podcast. And my focus into this podcast is to talk about how to make Anki cards. Anki cards based on doing UWORK, for example, or doing like questions from the MBME, like clinical mastery series questions, or doing like the full length practice exams and things of that sort. So I will just talk about some general guidelines. I will actually try to make this podcast as practical as possible. So I will give you very specific, like, oh, okay, this is an example of a question, like an MBME style question. These are the answer choices, like options A through E. I'll use a question from one of my videos, my OB-GYN video. And then this is a way I would put, I will intentionally get the question wrong. And then I will teach you how to make flashcards based on that. So just pay attention. Hopefully you find this to be helpful. And then I'll also give you just some general thoughts on, again, the process of studying for Step 2 CK. Because a lot of people study for these USMLE exams and they use relatively inefficient methods. The truth is, you can actually use... In fact, you know what? Let me hold my horses a little. I will talk about that towards the end. So let me just jump right into it. So, making Anki cards. The thing is, if you've listened to my podcast for any length of time, you'll see that personally, for me, I don't use Anki. But to be perfectly honest, I actually recommend Anki to certain groups of people. There are certain people that Anki works really well for. I feel like at the end of the day, as a medical student, as a healthcare professional, if you're studying for an exam, there are some just big general principles you need to keep in mind, right? And again, I promise I'll get to this Anki business. When you're studying for an exam, the first thing you want to do is you want to be comprehensive in your coverage of the material, right? So one mistake, classic mistake that's made by a lot of people, and also unfortunately some international medical graduates, is they start off studying for an exam and they use a resource that is not very comprehensive, right? A resource that does not cover the breadth of what they expect on an exam. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are certain people where using a super comprehensive resource may not necessarily be, say for example, for Step 2 CK, may not necessarily be the smartest thing for them or the most efficient thing for them. But I will say for the vast majority of people, starting out, like the very first time you make contact with a given piece of material, try to learn it from a comprehensive resource, because that will help you with not having gaps in your knowledge, right? You see people, they want to learn something for the first time and they are learning it from like an Anki deck. That is not smart. That is not prudent. Because yes, you may think you're learning. Yes, you may think you're committing things to memory. But many times there is little, if any, context behind that information. And as you'll see when you're taking MBME exams, you'll see that as you're reading, like, I mean, this is something that happens a lot of the time when I'm tutoring people. They tell me, or when I encounter people for the first time, when they, you know, reach out to me for tutoring, they say, but Divine, I've done this Anki deck, I've memorized all 20,000 cards, but my UWORK percentage is still like 30-40%, or I've done this awesome deck. And again, don't get me wrong, the Anki deck is an amazing deck. I mean, that whoever did that stuff is like super dedicated, super, super dedicated. In fact, I hope to be as dedicated as that going forward. But the thing is, when you are learning information, you need to learn in context, because the MBME does not ask recall questions. They do. Even UWORK, you know, does it occasionally. But for the most part, the MBME, they give you questions in a certain context. So say, for example, if you memorize statins, statins are HMG CoA reductase inhibitors. Yes, that is good information to know. That is a factoid. And that is a classic Anki card you will see out there. But the thing is, ask yourself, how many times have you truly seen the MBME just straight up test that factoid that, oh, statins are inhibitors of HMG CoA reductase? No, right? There are many other ways they can test that things. They will still test that core knowledge, but they will test it in the like in other contexts that will still draw up that knowledge, but it's not like a direct asking of the question. For example, they could give you a question, talk about a person that has like a hyperlipidemia or something, or they may give it in the context of a person that has one of those familial hyperlipidemias, and then say a drug is administered, right, that inhibits the HMG chorion reductase, blah 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 blah. So they are literally telling, like, you're like, oh man, this thing I already memorized. They're literally telling the question, the drug works by inhibiting HMG chorion reductase. Which of the following is the most likely explanation for why the patient is responding to this therapy, right? And then they'll put different answers, and obviously the right one will be like an increase in the number of LDL receptors, right, on the surfaces of hepatocytes, right? So the thing is, if all you've memorized is, oh, a statin inhibits HMG chorion reductase, great. But the thing is, if you see a different context on an NBME, right, then you're not able to approach those kinds of questions. So that is one thing you need to be careful about. If, for example, you have an Anki card that has context with it, great, that is awesome, right? Well, there are very few cards that have those kinds of contexts, right? Because again, it's kind of like fragmented information. And the power of Anki is in helping you with recall. It's not necessarily in helping you with understanding things, right? I see some people erroneously on, again, and I may be wrong. Again, I don't know everything, right? I may be wrong. I'm just speaking based on my experience just teaching and tutoring people for years, like for a really long time. So that's what I will say with that, right? So whenever you're learning, try to learn from a comprehensive, the first time you're learning something, right? Learn from a comprehensive resource, learn in context, right? In fact, if you're using someone else's Anki cards, don't just ask yourself, okay, go beyond, okay, this is the factoid on this card. Ask yourself, what contexts can this knowledge I'm staring at right in front of me on my computer screen, what contexts could this concept or piece of knowledge be tested in? I think that's probably, it will be much slower, right? But it's probably a more powerful way to learn than just saying, okay, I'll just rote memorize these 100 Anki cards that I have due for the day. So when you get to UWorld or like an MBME exam or whatever, and you're trying to make flashcards on that stuff, how do you approach that process? So let me give you an example. I'll read this question twice, and then I will talk about how I will make flashcards. And I will intentionally get the question wrong so that I model the process of teaching, again, showing you how to make flashcards. And the thing is, if you're not a flashcard person, you don't necessarily need to employ this method in making flashcards. Like for me, I'm more of like a notes person. So, and again, I'm not saying notes work well for everyone. There are people that Anki works better for. There are people that notes work better for. I'm one of those people that writing notes works better for. So the thing is, if you're taking notes on UWorld or whatever, this is also a strategy you can use. Because one common problem I see amongst people is you see them, they have notes from UWorld that is like a, you know, like a 200 page Word document or something, right? And then they never have the time to go back and review that stuff. Again, that is not prudent. Okay, that is not prudent. The thing is, it's better to have something manageable, maybe like, I don't know, like 20 pages long that you can read multiple times than to have a 200 or 300 page tome that you can only get through once, right? Because at the end of the day, after you learn information well the first time, you also need to repeat that information over and over again so that it goes into long-term storage. Okay, so I read the question. So a 22-year-old G1P1 female visits her obstetrician 1 week after she delivered a boy that weighed 6 pounds and 4 ounces. The delivery was unremarkable with Apgar scores of 8 and 9 at 1 and 5 minutes respectively. The patient plans to have her next baby when she graduates from school 2 years from now. In addition to routine screening for postpartum depression, what is the next best step in the management of this patient? I'll read the question again. A 22-year-old G1P1 female visits an obstetrician 1 week after she delivered a boy that weighs 6 pounds and 4 ounces. The delivery was unremarkable with Apgar scores of 8 and 9 at 1 and 5 minutes respectively. The patient plans to have her next baby when she graduates from school 2 years from now. In addition to routine screening for postpartum depression, what is the next best step in the management of this patient? I'll read the answers twice. Option A, discussion of the benefits of breastfeeding as an excellent long-term form of birth control. Option B, cervical swabs for Neisseria gonorrhea and Chlamydia trachomatis. Option C, prescription for a combined oral contraceptive pill. Option D, prophylactic sertraline for postpartum depression. And then option E, obtaining consent for the administration of depo-medroxyprogesterone acetate during this visit. Okay, so let me read the options again. Option A, discussion of the benefits of breastfeeding as an excellent long-term form of birth control. Option B, cervical swabs for Neisseria gonorrhea and Chlamydia trachomatis. Option C, prescription for a combined oral contraceptive pill. Option D, prophylactic sertraline for postpartum depression. Option E, obtaining consent for the administration of depo-medroxyprogesterone acetate during this visit. Okay, so I will go ahead and pick option C here. I promise you option C is wrong. The right answer here is actually option E, okay? But let's say I choose option C, right? Prescription for a combined oral contraceptive pill. But the right answer is option E, obtaining consent for the administration of depo-medroxyprogesterone acetate during this visit. And I know some people listening to this podcast, they always want Divine to drop some knowledge on them. So I guess let me explain. So the thing is, this person is postpartum, right? When a person is postpartum, at least for the first like 6 weeks or thereabouts postpartum, you cannot give any kind of contraceptive option that contains estrogen. If you give an estrogen-containing contraceptive option, the thing that's going to happen is that you will effectively decrease the woman's milk supply. So like the protein content of the milk that she's giving the child will not be adequate, right? So that is why if you, again, visit any, you know, like an actual, like reputable OB-GYN doctor, they will not give you any estrogen-containing contraceptive option. Right, so that's why option C is wrong, because the combined oral contraceptive pill, right, contains estrogen and progestin, right? But option E is correct, because the depo-medroxyprogesterone acetate, right, is just progestin, so that doesn't mess up the milk supply. And obviously option D will be wrong. You cannot give prophylactic sertraline, because this woman, we've not diagnosed her with postpartum depression yet, right? And there are no indications in the question that she has postpartum depression, so it would not make sense to just prophylactically give someone an SSRI for depression. Again, remember, every drug you give has side effects, regardless of how people tell you. Even vitamins have side effects, right? You just need to compare the risk benefit ratio. The benefits of obviously of taking vitamins outweighs the risk. That's why I take a multivitamin every day, right? So this is all like a risk benefit thing, right? So if you don't have depression, you shouldn't be on an SSRI or any, I guess, psych disorder that demands using an SSRI. You don't get yourself on those, right? And then cervical swabs for Neisseria gonorrhea and Chlamydia trachomatis is not indicated here. There's nothing in the question to support it. This is not like some young person that is sexually active and not using contraception or anything like that. That's not the setting. This is not a person that is having like risky sexual behaviors. And at least I don't give you any evidence of that in the question. So you should not pick that answer as well. And then discussion of the benefits of breastfeeding as an excellent long-term form of birth control. No, that's wrong. Again, breastfeeding is great, but if you don't want to get pregnant, don't depend on breastfeeding. It is very accurate. Your chances of becoming pregnant while breastfeeding, if you're having sex with your husband, is very minimal. But, or almost non-existent, but there is always the one person that is an exception. So I will encourage you, if you know you don't want to get pregnant, be smart, right? Be smart. So let's assume I go with option C, which is wrong, and I know that option E is correct. And notice, I've just explained why option C is wrong and why option E is correct, right? So let's say all these things I just said, where I walked through it, because this is essentially what your world does, right? All the answer choices, they will explain why this is right, this is wrong. They will give you an educational objective at the end. They will give you a discussion on the correct answer, right? The thing is, if I wanted to make flashcards or notes on this, my flashcard will be like that. So the first process I will go through is I would keep my notes away and carefully read the answer explanation. Read it from beginning to end, right? So this whole thing of I will do your world questions and review the questions I got right, the ones I got wrong, and then let go of the ones I got right. That is not a smart principle, okay? You've spent probably almost $400 or $500 on UWorld. You might as well get your money's worth. And the thing is, you can learn a lot from UWorld questions, even if it's a question you get right. So, you may not spend copious amounts of time reviewing the question you got right, but you really should still review that question you got right. So, I've explained, you've read the UWorld explanation and all that stuff. Unfortunately, this does not apply to the MBMEs. The MBMEs provides zero explanations. That's where my role as a tutor comes in. I usually do this process of go through each option with students I work with. But basically, how do you make UWorld a UWorld flashcard on this? Right? So let's ask ourselves, how do I write the question for the Anki flashcard? Well, the way I would write this question if I were you is 22-year-old female, comma, recently postpartum, comma, inquiring about the best means of birth control. So notice it is a pared down question. You don't need to write down the entire vignette. Again, you want to be efficient with your studying, right? So writing out the whole question is probably not the smartest thing in the world. And the thing is, you've read that question, you've read the explanation. The thing is, most people say, oh, Divine, I have a terrible memory. The truth is, when people say, oh, I have a photographic memory, blah, 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 to be honest with you, I really don't believe in that. I know some people may say, oh, Divine, come on, you do all this teaching. Of course, you have a photographic memory. No, I don't. I promise you, I don't. The thing that happens is, I've just worked in my strengths, and again, I'm very thankful for this. I'm not saying this to be proud or anything, but you essentially use your strengths to your advantage. I've found ways that work for me to commit large amounts of information to memory, right? And those ways require some effort, right? So you cannot work for 5 minutes a day and commit everything to memory. No, it's not possible, right? So when people tell you that, when you see people get these high scores on exams, and they tell you that, oh, they only invested an hour a day of work, that's not true, right? People that have great success, they also put in some great levels of hard work, right? So there is always a story behind the glory, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind. So notice the first thing. It's a pared down question, right? 22-year-old G1 P1 female, recently postpartum, requesting the best means of contraception. That's it. So that's your question, right? And then, or you can say, what is the best means of contraception, right? You can put like a small vignette, 22-year-old G1 P1 female, recently postpartum, new line. What is the best means of contraception, right? And then, when you're writing the answers in the back, right, your answers, you really should try to keep them down to no more than 3 sentences, right? You see people when they're writing UWorld notes, when they're making Anki cards, they make these long, super long things. Again, that is not prudent. That wears you out, right? And again, I feel bad for med students because especially medical education in this country, med students already, at least most med students, I have seen some truly lazy med students, but most med students work pretty hard, right? But there's no point like doing unfruitful work, right? No point wearing yourself out. So where should those 3 sentences come from? The first sentence should be what is true. Okay. The second sentence should be what is false, what you got wrong. And then the third sentence should be relevant pathophysiology, if any. Sometimes I even tell people that they should mix up sentence 1 and 3 together. So for example, let me give you 2 potential formats for answers here. One answer could, what my sentence 1 could be progesterone-based contraception. That's sentence 1. Sentence 2 is estrogen-based contraceptive options are wrong because they decrease milk supply in the female. The thing is, if you noticed, or I could also do like progestin-based, so sentence 1 could be progestin-based contraceptive options because they do not interfere with milk production. period. Sentence 2. Estrogen-based contraceptive options are wrong because they decrease the protein content of the woman's milk. Period. That's it, right? So notice what I did here. I talked about the right thing, and I talked about why. I talked about the wrong thing, and I talked about why it was wrong, right? The thing is, when you're, and that's pretty much it. You don't need to do anything beyond that. So some of you may be saying, okay, so Divine, why? What's the reasoning behind that? The reasoning behind that is, first, we've written a question that gives you context. Second, we've written answer choices that don't just give you what is right and what is wrong, but it actually helps you compare and contrast. The thing is, whenever you can make your notes able to compare closely related pathologies, those notes are a lot more powerful and a lot more useful on exams. Because again, at the end of the day, the way the NBME sets up questions is, at least this is the way I envision that they set up questions. And it's not just a matter of me envisioning. This is something that if you read between the lines, again, I do a ton of question, and I've done tons of question analysis in my lifetime, right? So it's fairly obvious that this is a potential mechanism behind the way the NBME writes questions. When the NBME is writing a question, the way they usually set it up is, there's a concept that they want to go after. There is usually one central concept they want to go after, right? So that's the first step. Then the next step is they ask themselves, okay, well, what is a clinical context that buttresses this point? They come up with that clinical context, right? And then they also consider, is there any close clinical scenario that looks fairly similar to this clinical context that we really want to test, but, you know, is not really it? And then they write the question like, you know, most of the question will support the right thing, but then they will maybe throw in a sentence or two that may make you think of something else that is not right. And then they will put a bunch of answer choices, right? You know, they'll obviously be the right answer. There'll be the answer that is wrong, but is in a closely related pathology. And then they'll put some answers that just don't make sense. They just don't fit with the timeline, right? So say, for example, let's say a person has like 12-hour onset of severe right upper quadrant pain. They'll put like cholangiocarcinoma as an answer. It doesn't make any sense, right? You cannot get cholangiocarcinoma in 12 in 12 hours, right? It's more likely to be an acute answer, right? So that's the way the NBME sets up these questions, right? So that is the reasoning behind me saying that when you're writing out answers to an Anki card, or you're writing out notes for a question, it makes sense to write the right answer and the wrong answer, and why the right answer is right and why the wrong answer is wrong. And again, force yourself to pare down each of these things to a sentence. What is the right answer and why? What is the wrong answer and why? That process of thinking so hard that you force yourself to pare the information down to one sentence also helps with solidifying that knowledge you've gone through in your head. So again, notice what I did here. So let me just summarize. You read the question, you read the answers, right? After you read the answers, and again, read it slowly, without notes or anything by your side, right? You see people, they are like, they read one sentence, they make a card. They read the next sentence, they make a card. They read the next sentence, they make a card. That's one of the things that wears med students out, right? Read the whole explanation and then face the computer away from you, or the answer choices away from you. And then make your pared down question, and then write out the maximum 3 sentences you need to capture these thoughts I just conveyed. What is the right answer and why? What is the wrong answer and why? And any relevant pathophysiology could take up a 3rd sentence if you've not already incorporated it in sentence 1 and sentence 2. So, what is a common question I get when I say this? People may say, oh, but Divine, how about all the other valuable pieces of information in a UWorld question? Well, I would give you 2 responses to that. One is, remember that you spent time reading and understanding that answer explanation. The thing is, you will very likely remember that context if you see it in the future. Again, you may not believe that your brain is able to do this, but I promise you, if you are going about the process of learning and studying the right way, your brain will register that. That's one. The second point with that is, when you make flashcards and the sentences you make in your answer choices relate to just what you got right and why, I mean, what the right answer is and why, and the wrong answer you chose and why, the thing is, you're essentially playing to your brain's strength. What do I mean by that? The thing is, the fact that you did not pick those other answers means that your brain subconsciously knows that they don't work for the context that was thrown in front of you. So, yes, there may be some valuable information that you miss out on doing this, but the thing is, one, you'll be a lot more efficient, and two, those other pieces of information that you are not necessarily making a flashcard for usually ends up not being as important as you think in the end. Again, in making notes, this mantra that I'm expressing to you, I have used that mantra pretty extensively for years, and thankfully I have done very well on exams doing that, right? Again, I will talk about kind of like a pre-process that may play into my results, right? But the thing is, at the end of the day, when you try to make flashcards on everything, because the thing is, when you're studying, again, you want to, I just kind of think of this as almost like the Pareto principle, right? You want to use your time to get the biggest bang for your buck, right? So it's almost like I spend 1 hour and I get $30 of benefit from it. And I spend 3 hours and I get $40 of benefit from it. Yes, you know, I'm losing out on $10, but that 1 hour of work that I did for $30, if I do it another day, like another 1 hour, $30, and that 1 hour, $30, for 3 hours, I end up making $90 versus 3 hours, end up making $40, kind of deal, right? Usually, the pieces of information that end up being the most relevant for you to take away with you to an exam ends up being what is conveyed in the wrong answer you select, and what is conveyed in the right answer you select, and what is conveyed in the relevant pathophysiology behind the context that a question is trying to push out. The other stuff may be valuable, but I promise you, and again, I guess this may require you to just have some, I guess, element of faith in what I'm saying. But I promise you, in the long run, those extra tidbits of information you're making flashcards on don't end up being, at least the vast majority of them, don't end up being as important as you think. That's one. Now, you may say, okay, so Divine, what is your own process of study, right? Like, do you start on questions first or whatever? Well, I'll tell you this, and you've probably heard this from, and I'll encourage you, if you're a med student, especially starting out med school or starting out third year, or if you're any kind of learner, I will encourage you to go ahead and listen to my podcast on the central dogma of studying. It's probably one of the best podcasts I have ever made on how to study. It's almost like philosophical in a sense, but I feel like it will help someone tremendously if they, again, take what they hear and carefully consider. And again, I'm not saying I have all the answers. In fact, there may be some stuff I'm saying right now that is wrong, right? That is why, especially in the world we live in today, where, you know, you can be fed with information from anywhere, it's also important for you to think in terms of your values, think for yourself, and then select that thing that is good from whatever information that is put out there. Even if something is bad, there may actually be some good you can extract from a bad piece of information. You could learn how to not do something, for example. So what is my process? So the thing is, personally for me, I don't believe in jumping into questions. I've just never found any benefit from doing that. So personally, and I've also noticed that it's very ineffective, at least for me. Again, I'm saying for me. But I feel like this also applies for a decent number of people. Jumping into questions, I found that to not be very efficient, because when you jump straight into questions, you don't have any basis, you don't have any background, right? and you're just reading a question, maybe because you've just never seen the information before, you get it wrong. You know, you get it wrong, it sucks. One, that kind of knocks you down from a psychological perspective. Although there is nothing wrong in getting things wrong. In fact, failure is actually good. Failure is good. Because the thing is, I mean, again, I guess people may think at some point during this podcast that, oh, Divine is a motivational speaker of some sort. I guess I actually try to motivate students, but failure is good, right? Obviously not on an exam, right? But the process before an exam, having failures in that process is not a bad thing. Because when you fail, you find out what you're doing wrong, and then you work on those areas. Right? Because many of us have strengths, but if you work on your weaknesses, you end up living a more high-yield life. You just get more from life when you're spending time really shoring up, like, you know, really working on your weaknesses, and then every now and then shoring up your strengths. So the thing is, personally, I believe in learning first before approaching questions. Because I've noticed that when I learn first, you know, I read a book or I listen to a video or something, and then, so when I learn, and then I go into questions after that, if I get something wrong, then that tells me that my process of learning the bit of information behind that question was flawed. And then I go back and fix that error. Right? And then, as I keep going through more and more questions, like I learn, I do questions, I get something wrong, I go back. Oh, what was the error in my thinking? What was the error in my thought process? I go fix that. If I keep going through that iterative process, I may start my learning with like 10 errors that I like, oh, like just unconscious errors or conscious errors that I have. And then as I keep erasing them, I get to a point where I'm almost like at 100%, where I'm like, okay, I know everything. I know why I got this right. I know why I got this wrong. I understand it from different angles, right? Like if you notice when I give podcasts, you see me, I take this bit of knowledge and I just start integrating with different disciplines. That process is, again, I'm thankful for being able to do that. But that process is born from just being able to compare and contrast things, right? And it's from going through this iterative process of learning first. After I learn, I go, I do questions. Because the thing is, it's just a lot more, I almost think of it this way, right? If, for example, you lose money on something, let's say, like you go to a casino and you lose money, right? You lost money, you're like, man, I lost money, that sucks. But you know, it's like a random event. You know, you had very little control over it, right? You know, so, you know, it may suck for a few minutes, few moments, well, I guess depending on the amount you lost. But after a while, you kind of put it out of your mind. You're like, yeah, this is chance. I don't know what's going on here. Screw that. But let's say, for example, you lose money because a friend you know cheated you, right? You feel terrible and you're less likely to forget that event because you're like, man, I knew this is my friend. This is my close buddy. I still got cheated, right? So the thing is, it's almost like the same way for me. If I've read something well, I've learned it the best I can, and then I notice I get a question wrong. Like those questions and even reading the answer explanation is just a lot more memorable in my mind because it essentially forces me to say, okay, so Divine, you read this thing, but you know, you're still making this error, right? So there's some error in the way you're thinking about this thing. And then when I go and fix it, I notice that I'm more likely to remember that thing even better, right? So again, that is, I guess I'm trying to explain because, again, I don't just want you to accept what I'm saying based on faith. I also want you to see the reasoning behind why I'm recommending this method for making notes on questions or for making Anki cards based on your world or like the MBME exams. Now, the next major question I get from people is, Divine, what kinds of questions, should I make flashcards on every question I do? And the answer to that is no. You should not make flashcards on every question you do. You should only make flashcards on questions you get wrong or questions you get right because you guessed. I'll say that again. You should only make flashcards over questions you get wrong or questions you get right for the wrong reasons. Because you guessed, because you were like, oh, I stare at the sun. if the sun is shining through this part of my window, then it should be option A. You know, that's probably not a smart way to take exams. So you should make flashcards for those purposes. And again, use the method I have prescribed early. Now, in terms of studying, what should you do, right? The thing is, for like step one, step two, CK, step three, whatever, it doesn't matter whatever exam you take. Again, I always advocate, start with a comprehensive resource. Start with a comprehensive resource you can get through in a reasonable amount of time, right? So say, for example, if you're studying for step two CK and, you know, there's like a 500 page book you can read and capture most of the high yield information tested, then that's a smart play, right? It would not make sense to go and pick out like a 2000 page tome to read for step two CK. That's just not possible, right? It's just not, right? So the thing I tell people is find a good, relatively manageable, high yield resource. If it's online MedEd, if it's first aid for step two CK, if it's step up to medicine, if it's whatever resource, that whatever floats your boat, use, just make sure it's comprehensive, right? And the thing is, when you're going through it that first time, really try to make sure you're understanding what is going on. Like, really try. Really try to make sure you understand what in the world is going on with this resource. Because again, if the understanding is there, then you'll be more apt to using that information well, using it the right way on exams. I mean, obviously, I would recommend my podcasts and my videos. I feel like I have comprehensive material pretty much for step two CK. I have comprehensive material for internal medicine, for psych, for neuro, for OB-GYN, for surgery, for peds. So antibiotics, microbiology, pharmacology, even for step one, right? I have pretty comprehensive, but I won't say my step one material is all comprehensive, but I will say I probably have covered like 40 to 50% of the material tested on the exam in my step one relevant podcasts. So find a comprehensive resource. Like for me, the way I go about things is I don't mind watching a video and, you know, making notes on the video. The thing is, when you're going through this comprehensive resource, you want to find a way to pare that resource down. If it's like keeping note of like even like a topic header, like topic headers, like, oh, on this page, these are the three key topics, right? Just find a way that. So for example, right, let me use my videos as an example. So let's say you watch my videos, let's say you're preparing for like your medicine shelf. You watch my four medicine videos, you make notes on it, right? That first contact with the material will take you a lot of time. My medicine videos come to what, like 11 hours, I think, of material. But again, they're very comprehensive, right? So you watch those 11 hours, you know, you kind of space it out. That's again why it's important to start early, right? Don't wait till the last week of your clerkship to start going through resources. That's probably not smart, right? So you'll watch the videos over like 3-4 weeks or thereabouts. You make notes on them. And then those notes, you go back and review them over and over again. The thing is, watching the videos and making the notes may take you like 20 hours total of work. But the thing is, when you go through those notes that you've generated the second time, it may take you like 6 or 7 hours to go through them. When you go through it the third time, it may take you like 3 or 4 hours to go through them. When you go through it the fourth time, it may take you like just 2 hours to go through the whole thing. So the thing is, you go through the comprehensive resource the first time, you make good notes on it, right? So like, it probably doesn't make sense to, although you know what, actually I shouldn't say that, but let me say that and then maybe recant my statement with some context. So it probably doesn't make sense to go back and keep watching a video over and over and over and over again. For most people, right? It probably may, because the thing is, the process of note writing is a little more active, right? So you tend to get a lot more from that. But there are some people, like myself, for some exams, what I do, because again, I'm a very big time audiovisual person, right? Like for step one, I remember back in the day, I would watch a video. So I would learn the material really well the first time, right? So I will find like a super lengthy video or something, right? Learn this material, learn it from every angle. And then after that, I would find a video that gives me like the facts, but gives it to me straight and gives it to me quick and dirty, right?
So I would watch those videos over and over again, over and over again, over and over again, right? That is just my means of repetition. And another means of repetition, I guess, for me is also just teaching other people, right? If you're teaching and tutoring other people, you're going to be reviewing this. It's almost like teaching Anki in a sense, right? So it's like I'm doing my own spaced repetition, but I'm doing it either by watching videos. And the thing is, videos, I watch them on a schedule, right? So I kind of, again, just planning, right? So good planning. And then just teaching and all those things is almost like when you teach people, have to explain things to them, do your own question analysis and all that stuff. That's just another good way of reviewing the material, at least for me, right? Obviously, I know it's not something everyone can do. So that's my process with things, right? So that's the way I typically recommend that people learn a given piece of information. And again, if you follow, and when I do UWorld personally, I usually do UWorld in timed tutor mode by subject. So again, that's what works for me. It may not necessarily work for everyone, but let me explain my reasoning why I do that. The reason I do UWorld in timed tutor mode by subject is I feel that my study sessions end up being more efficient, one, and they end up being more useful when I study with focus, right? So for example, I'd rather spend 3 hours studying just OB-GYN than spend 3 hours where I'm doing questions random, and then I'm reviewing OB-GYN and psych and peds and neuro and medicine. That's great. The thing is, when you're doing things like that, it feels great in the moment. But the thing is, there is a time and a place for that. The thing is, again, that is not actually not a bad means of doing questions. Like doing questions random, it's actually not bad at all, to be perfectly honest. But I feel like with the time restrictions that med students have, you don't necessarily have time to keep jumping from kettle A to pot B to pot C to frying pan D. No, right? When you study with focus. Because the good thing with these MBME exams is those MBME exams are randomized, right? So because they have like questions that test, like the full-length practice exams, they test every which concept, that will give you that experience with encountering different types of information, right? So the thing is, so don't get me wrong here, right? I'm not saying that doing questions random is bad. It's not bad, but it's inefficient. The only situation, right? And this is because for me, for example, right, will I tell you that, oh, I've never done questions random before? No, come on, that'll be a lie, right? I have no reason to lie to you, right? I've done questions random before, but I do questions random when I feel like I've accumulated most of the high yield knowledge and I understand it for an exam. Then at that point, when I'm doing random questions, it makes sense because I have information from different angles. So if I'm reading a psych question that has like OB-GYN undertones, or I'm seeing questions of different kinds, it's almost like I'm learning with focus just because I know so much. So I'm able to like make all these integrations from question 1 to question 5 to question 7 to question 9, right? So the thing is, if for example, you know that your knowledge base is bad for starters, and again, everyone starts somewhere, right? You need to embrace that. I guess this is something that's also kind of like important for residency or any transition you're making in life. You need to embrace that new beginner mindset, right? Like, you know, everyone starts somewhere, right? So the thing is, when you're starting out and your knowledge base is not great and you don't know much, it makes sense to do something timed tutor by subject. That's just the truth. But as your knowledge grows and you're getting better, you can then begin to mix and match things. You can begin to go random, right? It makes more sense then. But if you're like, I'm going to do random from the very beginning, usually for most people, again, it's a great method to study, but most people don't have, this is part of the reason you see people, they say, oh, it took me a whole day just to review a 1 UWorld block. Well, that's why, right? I promise you, if you've spent time like learning the material from a resource first, let's say like, oh, you watch an OB-GYN video, right? And then you do like 40 OB-GYN questions and then you review them. It's not going to take you a day if you go through that process, right? So personally, the method I've found, just to kind of summarize everything I've said in this podcast, I found it best to first go through a comprehensive resource to learn information. Second, pare down that information into a mechanism that I can review repeatedly on a scheduled basis. That's essentially spaced repetition. Do questions in tutor mode by subject. Review those questions. Make flashcards or notes. For me, I'm a notes guy, but flashcards work great as well. Make flashcards or notes. And when I'm making those flashcards or notes, I make them based on questions I get wrong or I get right for the wrong reasons, like guessing. When I'm making notes / flashcards, I read the answer explanation completely first, not taking notes as I'm doing that. And then, as I do that, in my own words, if I'm making a note, I make a one-sentence clinical vignette that gives context. And then, for my answers on my flashcards, I have no more than three sentences. Sentence one, what is the right answer and why? That's the question I try to answer in my first sentence. Sentence two, what is the wrong answer choice I went with and why? And then sentence three, is there any relevant pathophysiology? I try to convey those things in two or three sentences, and that's it, right? So that's the process of studying. If you have any questions or you have any podcasts you want me to make, let me know. Again, I take requests, believe it or not. I do take requests from people. So as long as your request is reasonable and I have the time for it, because again, remember, I have many other responsibilities in my life. I'll be willing to honor. I mean, like, there are many podcasts that I've made just based on Divine. I don't see any podcast you have on this. I have a lot of trouble with this concept. Can you make this podcast for me? And even this podcast I'm making right now is based on a bunch of questions I've gotten from people, right, that use the website. And then, as I do at the end of every podcast, first off, please, it'll be great if you could subscribe to the podcast. You can subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. And I also have this podcast on Apple Podcasts. I have it on Spotify. I have it on Google Play. So please subscribe, leave feedback, whether good or bad. It will help me improve. And then I also have a YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention Podcasts and Videos. If you could, again, subscribe and leave good feedback, that would be very helpful. And one other thing I will say is I do offer one-on-one tutoring and also like large group tutoring for the USMLE Step 1. In fact, maybe let me talk about my course offerings, because many people have asked me, like, Divine, what kinds of tutoring do you offer, right? So pardon me, because this is, again, not an educational podcast, let me spend like 3 minutes talking about my course offerings, right? So I offer many things. Basically, let me maybe start with defining the exams I tutor for, right? So I tutor for Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, Step 3. I also tutor for the internal medicine in training exam. So if you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the internal medicine in training exam. I tutor for the ABIM internal medicine board exam. And then I also tutor for like preclinical med school exams. So the exams you take, like your basic science exams in med school. And then the shelf exams, I also tutor for those, right? So I tutor for every shelf exam, essentially. Now, what shelves do I tutor for? Again, let me be a little more specific. I tutor for the Pete's shelf, the surgery shelf, the OB-GYN shelf, the medicine, the internal medicine shelf, the family medicine shelf, the neurology shelf, the psych shelf, the emergency medicine shelf. I tutor for all those shelf exams. And also, if you're taking a critical care shelf exam, I also tutor for those. Those are not very common. That's probably like the least thing I tutor. But yes, critical care shelf exams, I tutor for those. And then if you have brothers, sisters, relatives, cousins, whatever in college, I tutor for the MCAT. I tutor mainly like general chemistry and also just college courses. I tutor general chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, biochemistry, histology, and physiology. I tutor for those. So what kinds of tutoring do I offer, right? Probably the most common kind of tutoring I do with people, probably the bulk of the tutoring I do actually, is one-on-one tutoring, right? So I meet people online, right? And I tutor them one-on-one. Right? So I do a lot of tutoring one-on-one. And then another thing I do is I do large group tutoring as well. So if you have a group of 5 or 6 people, again, just reach out to me. Again, I've tutored groups. I've taught lectures to classes of almost 400 people, believe it or not. So I tutor people one-on-one. I also do large group tutoring. And then I offer these things I call booster courses, right? So it's 20 hours for step one. It's 10 hours for step two CK or step three. And you can arrange them as single one-hour sessions for X number of days or two-hour sessions for X number of days. And in those sessions, they're ideal for people that are preparing for any of those exams. And essentially what I do is I review the must-knows for those tests, right? So like, oh, things that are very high yield that you do need to know. I review them like in a clinical vignette format. And one thing I've noticed, one weird outgrowth of that process is I've noticed that many people I do those with, we then end up identifying like actual weaknesses that they have with the exam. And then we work on them and then they get better and then they're happy, right? So the vast majority of people I've done that with, it has worked out very successfully for them. And then another thing I offer these, let's call them like error cleaning courses, right? So what do I mean by that, right? So see, this is something, again, I do with people all the time, right? So let's say you take a practice exam. And usually they'll give you those confidence bars as to how well you did on something. If your bar is really off to the right, you know that you did well in that area. If your bar is really off to the left, you know you're not very great in that area, right? So the thing is, people can meet me and say, Divine, for step 2 CK, I feel awful about cardiology. Help me here, right? It depends on the subject, depends on how vast it is, but this ends up being no more than 4 hours at the maximum. Most times, the vast majority of the time, it's a one-time, two-hour session. We meet, and I basically will erase all those deficiencies you have in that subject. That is the truth. Again, I've done this with tons of people, and again, it has worked really well with the people I've worked with. Now, the other thing I offer, and this is large group only, is a USMLE comprehensive course. So it can be for step one, it can be for step two CK, it can be for step three. If you have a group of between 5 to 7 people and you all agree together, right? And you say, okay, Divine, can we all meet at this physical location? Although there is also an online option, but I feel like these large group things work better when you do it with people, you're like physically present. If you all agree and you can provide a location, right? Reach out to me and then I can give you more details. The course ends up being about 100 hours worth, but we go over pretty much everything you need for a given exam. So it usually makes sense because, again, people's schedules are different. It usually makes sense. Find a group of people that you want to do this together with and then reach out to me and then we can set things up, right? At least I know I'm going to be offering a couple of those starting like from the middle of this month till about the end of a couple of times before the end of like June. So if you're interested in any of those things, please do feel free to reach out. And then I have admissions committee experience. So I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for over a year, right? So I've reviewed thousands of high quality applications. And I've also worked one-on-one with people that are like med students applying for residency. So like an ERAS application, or college students applying for med school, so like an AMCAS application. I do offer like one-on-one advising, or you can call it coaching for like, you know, like rec letters, editing personal statements, doing mock interviews, editing applications. This is a service I offer. And again, the vast majority of people I've worked with, they've actually matched at their first choice, right? So I think in general, you would find this to be really helpful. So again, just reach out to me. You can either reach out to me through the website or you can send me an email at Divine Intervention Podcasts, right? With an S at the end. So DIVINEINTERVENTIONPODCASTS @gmail.com. So if you need any of these things, reach out to me. I guess one other thing I forgot to mention that I offer is longitudinal tutoring. So if you're like a first year med student studying med school, or your second year med student studying out second year, or your third year med student studying out rotations, I can essentially tutor you like for your longitudinally throughout the year for like whatever, let's say like if you're a first or second year med student, I tutor for like your block exams in med school. But as I'm doing that, I'm also integrating step one knowledge along the way. And then I tutor during your dedicated period, or if you're a third year med student, for example, I tutor you for all your shelf exams, and then when you get to your dedicated period, I tutor you for step two. But the thing is, again, as I'm tutoring for your shelf exams, I'm setting you up from a mindset perspective for your upcoming board exam. Again, I integrate concepts, teach you test taking strategies, and all those things. So if you're interested in any of these things, again, use the email I send, divineinterventionpodcast@gmail.com, or reach out to me through the website. And again, I've made a lot of recent changes on the website, like I mention often, right? So if you go to the exam topics list, so if you go to divineinterventionpodcasts.com, if you go to the exam topics list, I update it regularly, but basically there's a Google Doc. You cannot edit it because I know people do like weird stuff online. So you cannot edit the Google Doc, but I edit it myself. But it's publicly accessible. And I basically, for step one, step two CK, step three, by every subject on those exams, I list out podcasts that I suggest for those things. So you just go, like if it's step two CK, internal medicine, you just go to the step two CK tab, click on internal medicine, you'll see all the podcasts I recommend. So use that. I update it every time I add a new episode. I mean, I'm going to update it when I add this episode 200. So there is that. I think that's probably the best means. And it even lists the episode numbers and everything so that you're not, you know, like going all over the place. So what are the things that I've covered on my website that I'm like, okay, I can say with confidence that I've covered really well, right? I feel like if you use my website solely as your study resource for step 2 CK, you'll be a master with step 2 CK knowledge, right? I feel like the vast majority, again, there is no resource that covers 100%, but I feel like I'm very closely approaching that 100% for step 2 CK. There's lots of people that have used my website resources as their sole source of content for the exam, and they have done extremely well on the tests. Not one person, not two people. These are people in the tens, in the hundreds, right? So take that for what you will. Now for step one, I would say that I have probably covered about 40%. This is just me being very conservative. I've probably covered about 40% of the material that's tested on step one. That is why in this new year, right? I mean, this new decade, I guess. In this new year, that is one area I'm going to be investing very, very heavily on over the next few weeks. Trying to get my step one content to that close to 100% number. And also step three and the internal medicine exams, I will say that I've maybe covered like less than 5%. Those are areas I want to work. Although actually, let me take that back. So the internal medicine resident specific content, I feel like I'm probably at around like 5%. For step three, actually, I will say I'm actually maybe more than 50% of the way, because I have some dedicated step three podcasts. But the thing is, step three has a lot of throwbacks to step two CK, right? So many of the step two CK material I have is very applicable to step three. So I would say that I probably have covered about 50 to 60%. I think I should have thought about that before I said that. Yes, about 50, 60% of what is tested on step three, I do think I have podcasts on those things, right? So those are kind of like the percentages. And for step one, because I know my step one audience is growing by the day, it's becoming a bigger and bigger audience. What are the things I feel like I've covered real well for step one? The things I've covered real well for step one, pharmacology. Basically, if you're going through first aid, like 99.99% of the pharmacology that's tested in first aid, I have amply covered them in my podcast. I mean, I used to run a pharmacology course at Johns Hopkins back in the day. Really successful. A ton of people found it to be really helpful. So pharmacology, I've covered essentially in its entirety. Biochemistry and metabolism, like genetic diseases, and all those biochemical pathways and everything, I've covered those in its entirety. Hematology and oncology, I've covered those in its entirety. Renal, covered that in its entirety. And then I have covered fairly, not comprehensively, but fairly well, things like cardiology, gastroenterology, pulmonology, endocrinology, MSK, rheumatology. So I've covered many of those subjects. Biostats, I have podcasts on biostats. So just pick out what works best for you. And then, and again, if there are any specific podcasts you want me to make, feel free to reach out and I'll be happy to help. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I will see you in episode 201. Thank you.